Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Remember Spirit and Opportunity, those little Mars rovers that started out on the planet in 2004 and were supposed to last, I think, 3 months, 90 days or something like that, but instead they lasted many, many years. I mean, it was probably the best return on investment of government money we've ever seen, right? And so Spirit lasted over 6 years until March 2010, and its twin brother or whatever, Opportunity, is actually still operating on the surface of Mars, although it's not roving around anymore, but it's still sending back data, I guess, about 9 years later. Huh? So do you remember how they landed on Mars? It was this wild thing with bouncing balloons or airbags, and the landers were like careening along on the surface of Mars for quite a distance before they stopped and then unfolded and began to do their work. It was a fantastic-looking thing, and we saw an animation of it, but the whole scenario was kind of cartoonish anyway. Now, more recently on Mars, there's a mission called Curiosity that landed on August 5th, 2012, and is currently running around on Mars at a top speed of about 8 feet a minute. It also had a very innovative landing system. My guest today is the NASA engineer who's responsible for those innovative landing systems. His name is Tom Rivellini. He actually works at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, a NASA field center run by Caltech in California, and he's so successful at this stuff that he was recently named one of Esquire magazine's Americans of the Year. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, Court.
Nice to have you on with us.
It's great to be on here, too.
So for an engineer, you must have a wild imagination. Did you grow up building, like, Rube Goldberg machines and taking apart the family TV and things like that?
I'm not sure about building lots of Rube Goldberg things, but I absolutely am guilty of taking apart just about everything in the house when I was a kid. It was an infatuation that I had, and it cost my mom quite a few appliances.
I'll bet. So you're one of those inventive engineers, which is great. Well, let's start with Spirit and Opportunity, which was a while back there. You're in charge of something called Entry, Descent, and Landing, which I guess is abbreviated as EDL.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us what it was like, what that system was like, and why and how you ended up with that totally original approach to getting to Mars.
Well, EDL is really a process of energy management. We have spacecraft that come flying in to Mars going roughly 12,000 miles an hour, and we have to basically get down to 0 miles per hour on the surface very carefully. And so EDL is just about managing all of that energy. Interestingly enough, we scrub out roughly 99% of all of that energy just with friction with the atmosphere. And so we designed these things called a heat shield, which is nothing more than a fancy structure with some really high-tech materials on the front side that get really, really, really hot. And that takes the spacecraft down from 12,000 miles an hour to roughly about 1,000 miles per hour. And that's where we open up our parachutes. And on Mars, the atmosphere is really thin. That's why we're able to open those parachutes up going that fast. But at the same time, even when you throw out a really big parachute, it doesn't do a great job. And so it only gets you down to about 200 miles per hour. And that's still too fast to land. And so then we come up with other devices and gizmos and gadgets to get our spacecraft down to the surface gently. And that's typically where you use rockets and other types of landing gear to get yourself from that 200 miles an hour hanging on a parachute down to basically 0 miles per hour very gently on the surface.
So it really is kind of like a Rube Goldberg machine. And I suppose you have to be a certain age to even know what a Rube Goldberg machine is. But it's this complicated gizmo that one thing starts it and then the whole thing unravels and proceeds in a step-by-step way in a fantastic sequence of events. So that's a multi-stage process you're describing there, and everything has to work right. I guess once it lands, it's out of your control, right? But just like takeoff and landing are the hardest parts of flying a plane, I guess landing on another planet is probably the hardest thing to do in space. So you mentioned the thin atmosphere, but why is that especially hard to land on Mars?
Well, you're right. It is a Rube Goldberg-type machine. These things almost always have to be because you have to package your entire spacecraft inside the fairing of a rocket. So rockets, they're big, but they're still pretty small compared to what you want. And you've got to protect your fragile little rover or whatever it is you're putting on the surface. And so you've got to wrap it and encase it in all sorts of systems to incrementally protect it. First, you protect it from the deep space environment, then you protect it from the high heat of entry, and then you've got to protect it from crash landing, and then you've got to get your system out. So all these things have to be packaged one inside the other. And a lot of times we make the analogy that it's kind of like a Russian nested doll, where the prize is down in the middle of it, but it has to be wrapped in all these layers of different parts of the spacecraft. And landing on Mars is particularly difficult because Mars has an atmosphere, but unfortunately it's not much of an atmosphere. So when the Apollo astronauts came back from the moon, for example, they had a modestly complicated system to do that. They had the heat shield and then they had the parachutes. But Earth's atmosphere is pretty darn thick. It's about 100 times thicker than Mars' atmosphere. And so a set of parachutes does a great job on Earth to bring a spacecraft gently to the surface where you can land it. But on Mars, like I mentioned before, parachute really only gets you down to a couple hundred miles per hour, which is just clearly too fast to land. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we've got to layer on all these extra systems to slow the system down even more. And the problem is all those extra systems, the rockets, the landing gear, the propulsion, the guidance, all this stuff is heavy. And so it just cascades all the way up through the whole system. I mean, you have to have a bigger parachute, and then you have to have a bigger heat shield, and it just cascades. And so, you know, one of the hard parts of our job is to design all of this stuff to be as light and efficient as possible. And that's just, you know, it's a very laborious, very time-consuming process to get that right.
So with Spirit and Opportunity, those airbags or whatever you'd call them, kind of like big beach balls that the units were surrounded by, was that your idea? I mean, had that ever been done before? Or where did that concept originate?
Well, that was interesting. So the Spirit and Opportunity airbags was actually a redo, if you will, of the Mars Pathfinder airbag system. And that was the first system that I worked on. It was the third successful lander that ever made it to Mars, the Viking 1 and 2 landers back in the 1970s. They were the first ones. Mm-hmm. And there was a very, very long hiatus where we didn't send any landers to Mars. And I started working at JPL in 1991. And one of the first assignments that I was given was to come up with some kind of a low-cost landing system for Mars landers, which you know, was really just a paper study at the time. And so myself and three other guys, we just kind of, you know, locked ourselves into a room for a few weeks and started brainstorming all sorts of crazy ideas. One of the ideas was actually a concept that came from NASA Ames, and they had proposed an airbag landing system. And so we looked at that and we thought, you know, that's a good starting point, but there's really no implementation there. So we started doing some research and started coming up with some ideas on how to use airbags for landing on Mars. And interestingly enough, one day I came into my office and there was this this report on my chair on how to use airbags to land on Mars. And I was like, whoa, this is pretty cool. And I look, and it was written in 1966, a year before I was born.
Oh, wow.
And I look at the author, and it was the guy that was sitting down the hall from me. And I was like, oh, my gosh, it's Bill Lehman. And so I went and talked to him about it. And they had done some really, really fantastic work back in the 60s on this subject. But they pretty much abandoned it because the materials at the time that they were using was literally Mylar and piano wire. And that just wasn't good enough to send anything to Mars. And so they kind of abandoned that. But, you know, it was 1991. We had Kevlar. We had, you know, new high-tech materials. And so we picked up that concept that they had worked on and started morphing it into something that would be useful for the spacecraft concept that we were developing. And so we put together this crazy idea on using airbags strapped to a tetrahedron-shaped lander that would bounce and roll and come to rest in any orientation and self-right itself just by virtue of opening up like a flower. And we would hang that from a set of rockets, and then we had a parachute on top of that. It was really a wacky idea at the time, but we had, you know, really good technical justification for it. And we sort of slowly and incrementally educated our management and the project folks on it. And everybody understood the physics of it. And so the fact that it looked crazy and looked Rube Goldbergian was kind of besides the point because it was actually well thought out.
So something like that can seem workable theoretically, right? I mean, you know, the materials can be right, like you described, and the process can be theoretically feasible. But when it gets to a certain level of complexity, it's really risky. And, you know, obviously that besets any kind of planetary mission, which is a extremely complex undertaking to start with. And you mentioned the long hiatus in Mars missions after Viking. And really, historically, Mars missions seem to have been jinxed for a long time. In fact, it's called the Mars Curse. The Russians had several missions to Mars that failed, and so did the Europeans, and so did we. So the Viking missions in the 70s were kind of ahead of their time. They were two extremely successful missions to the surface of Mars that sent back still pictures of Mars, but really wasn't until the mid-90s that we started succeeding regularly, and that's around the time you came along. You mentioned the Pathfinder and Sojourner mission that you started off as a young guy on, so I think you've had a perfect score so far, right?
Well, I wish. I too, got caught up in the Mars curse. So Mars Pathfinder was my first mission, and it was very successful. After that, I worked on a technology mission called the Mars Microprobe, the Deep Space 2 Mars Microprobe mission. And it was a very, very high-risk technology development project where we actually built and sent two small probes to Mars as piggyback payloads on the ill-fated Mars Polar Lander mission. And these two miniature probes were basically little penetrators. So the spacecraft itself was the size of a McDonald's salt shaker.
Oh,
that's
gosh.
How big it was.
Wow.
And we and then it was encased in an aeroshell, which was the size of basically a salad bowl. And it didn't have parachutes, it didn't have propulsion, it didn't have anything. It just had a little aeroshell, and it came flying into through Mars, and it would slow down to about 400 miles an hour, and then we designed it to just smash into the surface and bury itself. And as crazy as that might sound, we designed it and we tested the heck out of it, and it worked really, really well here on Earth in all of our tests. But unfortunately, we never heard back from either one of the two probes, and there was really no smoking gun that was ever found as to why we never heard back from them. We suspect that it got caught up in some of the failure modes associated with the Mars Polar Lander, and so it may have been a cascading type of failure scenario, but we'll never really know. But no, I'm not definitely not batting 100. I wish I were, but I'm still doing pretty good. I can't complain.
Yeah, I'd say very close. You're in the major leagues.
Yeah.
You are listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Tom Rivellini, who's the chief engineer for entry and descent and landing systems of Mars missions. He works out at JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, which is one of NASA's federal labs. So, Tom, the current mission is Curiosity, and that's your most recent baby. Why don't you describe the EDL, the Entry, Descent, Landing System for that, and something that I think is called the Sky Crane.
Yeah, so Curiosity is a fantastic system, a very ambitious science, but the very ambitious science required a large rover, and that rover required a lot of power. So we got asked to come up with a entry, descent, landing system for a 900-kilogram nuclear-powered rover. That was a very, very big challenge. And on top of that, the science community wanted to be able to send this rover into some of the most geologically interesting areas on Mars. Well, to a landing engineer, that means one of the most geologically dangerous places to land on Mars. And so that was the task that was given to the EDL team, was to come up with a landing system for this big nuclear-powered rover that can land just about anywhere on Mars. So one of the first things we did, actually, was to figure out if we could use airbags. I mean, airbags had been successful, very successful in the past, and it was sort of a natural next step. And so we spent, I'd say, almost a year trying to figure out how to make airbags work. And ultimately, what we found was that in order to maintain some of the heritage that we had developed for Mars Pathfinder and Spirit Opportunity, that for this big rover, we would have to slow the touchdown from 50 miles an hour down to 5 miles an hour in order to keep the same fabrics, to keep the same pressures, and keep our knowledge, make that still useful. We call that heritage. And so when we did that, we realized that, gosh, in order to come down that slow, we were going to have to put a much better radar on the system, we're going to have to put much better rockets on the system. Instead of having these rockets, it's called solid rockets, where you just turn them on, they fire for 3 seconds, and they slow you down, which is what we use for Spirit and Opportunity. We realized that we were going to need liquid rockets, where we had tanks and rocket motors that you could actually throttle. You could, you know, change the settings in on them so you could actually steer yourself and guide yourself in order to be able to bring this big airbag system down. And then we had sort of this epiphany where we said, gosh, if we're going to invest all this effort into a better radar, better rocket systems, we can just go a little bit further and bring the system down to, say, 1 mile an hour or half a mile per hour and get rid of the airbags altogether. And that was sort of the aha moment that the team had. And that led to what we now call the Sky Crane, which is basically a glorified airbag EDL system with better guidance, better propulsion, but no airbags. And it was the same kind of thing where when that aha moment happened, the engineering team, we just got it immediately. It's like, oh, yes, this is it. This is obviously the right answer. And again, it took some time to get the management folks up to speed on it, to make them understand, explain to them the physics of it. And, you know, here at JPL and even within NASA, you know, when you lay out a logical solution to a difficult problem and you can justify some of the crazy and wacky ideas that you have with some really hardcore math and some really hardcore physics and some really good logical thinking, you know, that's how you get these seemingly crazy ideas to get them moved forward into turning them into realizable systems. And that's exactly what happened with what we call the Sky Crane. So the team, you know, we latched onto it. We started doing simulations, and it started behaving really, really well in our simulations, and we got more and more confidence with it. And pretty soon that became the baseline landing system for our project. And then from there, we designed the rest of the EDL system around that. So we designed the propulsion system. We designed the whole sky crane. Then we designed a parachute, very, very large parachute for the system, the largest supersonic parachute we'd ever flown to Mars at this point. A very, very large aeroshell and a brand new cruise stage, which is what keeps the whole spacecraft alive during the transit from Earth to Mars. And we spent several years putting together this really, really ambitious system.
So I think another factor that I read is that the Mars dust is so light that coming down with these big rockets slowly, there was a concern that it would throw up this cloud of dust and dirt and gravel and debris that might then mess up the systems, right? And you'd get down successfully, but they wouldn't work. So you had to come down slow, but also find a way to keep the rockets off the surface. So there's this kind of two-part aspect to the sky crane that I think you might not have described. What was that about?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. It's there's no atmosphere. I mean, there's very, very thin atmosphere on Mars. So, you know, a rocket motor jet doesn't dissipate, doesn't spread out. So when it comes out of the rocket nozzle, so it's a sharp jet that comes out, and it's going to hit the ground, and it's going to start making a big hole in the ground and kicking up a lot of dust. And so we thought about that early on, and that was actually one of the things that sized the length of the ropes that connected the rover to the descent stage. And the other thing that we did is we actually angled our rocket motors out at an angle so they weren't pointed straight down. Obviously, that was to prevent the rocket motors from burning the rover, but also so that all the dust that it kicked up would kick it outwards. And we did a lot of simulations. We even did a lot of testing for this plume debris issue. And as it turns out, we got it mostly right, not 100% right. You know, if you go and look at some of the images at the JPL website and look at the top deck of the rover, you'll actually see pebbles and rocks and dust on the top deck of the rover. And obviously, they weren't there when we launched it, and they got kicked up during the landing process. So we know that there was a bunch of that material being kicked up and thrown around.
So the top part, which is the rocket part that's lowering the rover, then breaks loose with these ropes and flies away some distance and crash lands somewhere else, but you don't care about that. At that point, it's collateral damage, right?
That's right. We call it a bit of a Mars trash.
Yeah.
It's the descent stage does what we call the flyaway maneuver. As soon as it sets the rover down on the surface. The computers declare touchdown. They cut off the ropes and the umbilical connecting the descent stage to the rover, and the descent stage just flies up and away and just takes off like a bat out of hell, and it crash lands about half a kilometer away. And interestingly enough, the rover was programmed to snap a couple pictures seconds after touchdown. And we're pretty darn sure that in one of the cameras actually caught the plume of the descent stage crashing into the surface.
Hmm.
It's kind of a grainy image because the lens covers on the rover had dust picked up on them, as was expected. That's why they were dust covers.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a kind of a fuzzy image, but it's actually on the website. You can go take a look at that as well. It's pretty neat.
So these things are so crazy. You know, again, the Rube Goldbergian aspect to it, where all these things have to work in sequence perfectly for the whole thing to end up succeeding. And there's really no middle ground between success and failure. I mean, it either burns up in the atmosphere and crashes, or it pretty much lands and succeeds and works, you know, as long as the interior of the rover is working. So do you guys roughly try to calculate the odds of the thing working perfectly, or do you just kind of figure out the systems as best you can and then just basically keep your fingers crossed? I mean, obviously you have to keep your fingers crossed, but do you have some idea of, okay, we got a good chance that this is going to work, or, you know, how does that go, or what's your perception of that as the thing is approaching the planet?
Sure. Now, one of the reasons why these missions get to be as expensive as they are is because we try not to leave anything to random chance like that. And we calculate those probabilities very, very carefully. And so there's two sides. One is the sort of like the flight dynamics. What are all the environments that the spacecraft will be experiencing, and how do we control those environments so that it doesn't burn up, or so we won't blow out the parachute, or so we don't land going too fast? And we generate these very, very complicated flight simulations of the whole EDL process. And we take every single variable that we can imagine, and then we add some in on top of that. We play around with the atmosphere. We play around with the mass properties of the spacecraft, how all the weights are distributed. We change the variations on how the propulsion system works, how the parachute works, all the characteristics of the whole spacecraft and the Mars environment that can be simulated in a big mathematical model. We'll put all those variables in there. And then for all these different variables, we'll run simulations and we'll change all those variables. And we literally run millions and millions of simulations where we change one variable at a time. We change multiple variables at a time and see how these different things interact. We would call those Monte Carlo simulations because you take all these variables and you roll the dice inside the computer, and then it runs the simulation with this random set of variables. And it's a very, it's a very common practice in engineering to do these types of Monte Carlo simulations. And we do that. Like I said, we do millions and millions of these simulations in order to come up with, very good probability. We try to get into mid to high 90% chance of things working perfectly. And we don't always succeed, but a lot of times if you do everything right, you know, things will come out just fine.
There's a 7-minute, I think it is, communications time lag in signals coming from Mars. So you know the system is down, but you don't know if it's crashed or landed. And what's that period of not knowing like? I mean, when you get the good news, the exhilaration must be unbelievable.
Yeah, that's kind of a humorous and aggravating phenomena. It's humorous because there's just nothing you can do about it, right? And so from a psychological standpoint, you just sort of shift everything into what we call Earth receive time, because it doesn't matter what's actually happening out there. You can't control it. We're not joysticking the spacecraft. It's all completely robotically controlled. The computer's doing everything once you get into the EDL process. And so it's basically hands-off. And so, 10 minutes before, we actually get the signal back, we're all kind of chuckling and joking, saying, well, we're on the surface of Mars one way or the other. It's either a big pile of junk or it's a perfectly working spacecraft. Really not much in between. So that time period goes by and everybody just kind of laughs and kind of look at each other kind of funny. And then we get the Earth receive time, where we start to get all of the radio signals that have spent their time traveling through space. They finally make it to Earth. They make it to our antennas and into the control room. And basically, not a lot of information that we can pump through. It's not like, high-def cameras or anything like that. We get these little radio signals that we can interpret what the spacecraft is doing as the signal arrives. And then from that, we can determine if it's operating properly. To get pictures and get real data takes longer. But as we're getting this radio signals from Mars, we can tell right away if the spacecraft is doing what it's supposed to.
Yeah, so that whole period of waiting, I mean, you describe it as being kind of chuckling and laughing, and you make it sound a little more relaxed than I think it is, really, because you can go to YouTube, and there's a couple of videos, actually real-time videos of these guys in the room watching this, and, you know, there's some kind of context for it, too, in the videos. One is called Curiosity's 7 Minutes of Terror, which I suspect describes it a little more accurately than chuckling. And so there's that, and then also Curiosity Has Landed. So two different videos on YouTube that you can look at. Just briefly, Tom, we've just got a minute or so left to go, but what is Curiosity's mission? What's the rover doing up there?
So Curiosity is looking for organic chemistry. It has a very sophisticated organic chemistry laboratory, and finding organic chemistry is sort of, you know, one of the steps to determining if there ever has been life on Mars. Not directly the ability to say, hey, we have life here on Mars, but if there ever had been life, it would have left traces, clues, in the form of organic chemistry strewn out all over the surface. And that's what the rover is out there looking for.
So what's the next mission going to be?
Well, that's still in the planning process right now. So we have a commitment from NASA headquarters to do the year 2020 mission using a spacecraft very similar to Curiosity, but the payload hasn't been decided yet. And so there's a whole bunch of folks right now working on trying to figure out what's the next science investigation to do. Should it be part of a Mars sample return mission? Should we be pre-selecting samples and collecting them and waiting for even a follow-on mission after that to actually bring them back? Or should it be a mission where it only does science with the rover? There's still a lot of planning going on with respect to what the objectives of the next Mars mission in 2020 will be.
I notice you have a new title, Chief Engineer of Low-Density Supersonic Decelerators. So I'm guessing that means that whatever the next mission is, the payload's going to be very big and you're going to have a different kind of deceleration mechanism to get it to land, huh?
Yeah. So one of the things that NASA headquarters did a few years ago is they reinstated the Office of the Chief Technologist. And so rather than focusing technology development into the flight projects, there's a renewed effort within NASA to fund technology development projects just for the sake of developing technologies for missions that don't even know that they need these technologies yet. And it's really fantastic because it's allowed us to start planning for much, much larger missions to Mars that eventually will happen. For example, Mars sample return missions, robotic precursors for human space flight to Mars, and even human missions to Mars. We know that we will need much, much larger EDL systems. And those things don't just get invented overnight. They take incremental development, incremental failures, incremental successes along the way in order to develop those technologies. And that's what we're doing.
Well, Tom, I'm sure you work really hard, but you do sound like one of those people who feels like you get paid to play a lot of the time. So congratulations on your successes so far, and we'll keep up with what the next step is. Thanks for being on with us on American Variety. It's been great.
Thanks, Court.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.